It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up on today's Wisconsin Life, we'll hear from a children's author who wrote his first book at the age of 85. But first, over the weekend, the country lost one of its most recognizable advocates for civil rights. Julian Bond was active in the civil rights movement from his teen years until his death at the age of 75. He not only participated in many iconic events and key organizations, but was also a leader in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, the NAACP, and the Southern Poverty Law Center. Bond was familiar to many Wisconsin residents not just because of his national profile, but because he was a frequent visitor to the state. In fact, he stopped by Madison's Edgewich College last March and issued and addressed the issue of police shootings of black men. Joining us to talk about Julian Bond's legacy is Greg Jones. He's the president of the Dane County chapter of the NAACP. Greg, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you, Veronica. Good to be with you.
Well, Julian Bond, he really grew up with the civil rights movement. What stands out from his early years of being an activist and an organizer?
Well, I think what stands out is he captured a moment of courage. At that time and in this country's history, particularly in the South, which was so segregated along racial lines and in need of modernization in terms of civil rights, Julian was one of those who probably didn't intend to be a leader, but was propelled into that position. And then, of course, I think he took it on his shoulder, and over the long journey of his life, he has just been impeccable in terms of standing up for justice and equality.
Well, for someone who stood up in many turbulent times, as you said, his calm demeanor has been noted a lot. Ambassador Andrew Young, who is a member of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference during the Civil Rights Movement, had this to say about Julian Bond over the weekend.
When everybody else would be getting all worked up, I could find in Julian, a cool, serious analysis of what was going on.
What can you tell us just about the way that Julian Bond was, his demeanor, and how he approached things?
Well, I think if I were to summarize his character on one level, it would be strength through poise. And the two times that I met him, once I was in an audience here at UW-Madison's campus and just listened at his words and how they were aligned, the points he made, and how they stuck with you and had meaningful thought. And I did meet him and chatted very briefly at the Edgewood event this past March and purchased a book, his latest book, that he had worked on, Black Leaders on Leadership. And I was introduced as a local chapter president of Dane County NAACP, and he just shook my hand and he just said, "We have to move forward." And that's all he needed to say after an inspiring presentation. So I think for me, it was, his stature was not that threatening, but his words were so strong. And that's what motivated a lot of people and inspired many in my generation.
Now, I read that in his later years, Bond said he was no longer opposed to violence. He said it was hard to separate history from violence in that context working together. What do you make of that change?
Well, I guess a couple of things come to mind, I think, when I think about the evolution of Julian. And let me be clear that when we say Julian, it is a term of endearment. I think when we all, my age and my generation, he is endeared for what he did. But I think when you think about that statement, I first go to the documentary Eyes on the Prize, and I think that was one where I would watch it before I had kids, and then when kids came along, we made it a point to watch it, and I think what they noticed was that violence had been perpetrated on African Americans, particularly in the pursuit of civil rights. So while it was directed at African Americans, and as we move forward in this time, we see that such violence is still problematic in many of our communities. And I think what my takeaway is that he may not be opposed to it, but he may not utilize it as a tool, because I think when I go back to his relationship with Dr. King and SNCC, a Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, they were all about standing up, bringing pressure and bringing points to bear on issues that were marginalizing a great, great number of American citizens. So I think it was an evolutionary statement, but I think for him, he understood the fact that that we were fighting for rights for all, and that to get to a true anti-racism movement, it was going to require a lot of different tools. But I don't think it was espousing the use of violence.
We're talking to Greg Jones now, president of the Dane County NAACP, talking about the death this weekend of civil rights leader Julian Bond. You mentioned his relationship with Dr. King. What was that relationship like?
Well, as I understand it, I was not there, but I do think that he was considered one of the lieutenants. I think he provided a great deal of connections and relationship from SNCC to other civil rights movements and organizations. And together, I think that they propelled different segments of the African-American community to get involved. Because I do think Dr. King had contact and influence with the larger groups, maybe the African-American churches and other faith-based organizations and churches. And I think what Julian was doing was in the streets, whether he was involved in registering voters, whether he was involved in sit-ins, and that could have been in lunchrooms, bus stations. And those things came together to create a much broader civil rights movement and momentum behind the movement. So I think they had a working relationship, quite positive. I haven't done a lot of research on it, but it seems to me that, from what I am aware, that collaboratively with all of the groups, they were able to be successful and move that Civil Rights Act and amendment forward.
Now, Julian Bond spoke in Madison in March of last year, just 1 week after the shooting of Tony Robinson by a Madison police officer. What was it like for the African-American community to have such a well-respected, such an influential leader here right after that tragedy?
Well, I think whenever we hear the name Julian Bond is going to be in our community, what happens is that we know that that the community or the entity that brings him here or brought him here has an interest in seeking sustained justice and equality on some level. So when you bring a person in of that stature and of that history, he brings a message that is mostly most often relevant to the community. So when he was here and he gave his presentation and we met him afterwards and talked with him, you could just sense that on the one hand it seemed surreal to be so close to a person who had fought the fight and who had walked the walk, and for so many years provided leadership to the largest civil rights organization, which was the National NAACP Board of Directors. So we know that for a person to become real in your eyes by touch and feel, you're somewhat humble, but you're also inspired, because you know that that individual had a vision throughout his life, starting in those early years and continuing to now, that he wanted to make a difference for all people.
Now, Julian was a witness to the birth of the Black Lives Matter movement, and he saw it take off over this past year. Do you have any idea what he thought about that and how he sort of placed it in the context of history alongside maybe the civil rights movement?
Well, I'm sure that there had to be a moment of reflection. I'm sure that if he went back to his early years, he thought about SNCC and how those young people stood up or sat down to raise a light or to shine a light on the issues of the day. And I think he probably understood that that the Black Lives Matter, and in Madison, the Young, Gifted, and Black, that they are playing a critical role in raising issues, opening up discussion, and lending themselves to make the kind of changes that were needed and necessary back when Julian was younger.
Now, just on the human side, he was apparently a poet, too. Did you know that about him?
Oh, not necessarily a poet, but I think I can understand that. He was a great orator, in my opinion. So,
what did you like about the way he spoke?
Excuse me. Got a little cough. For me, he had a pleasant style, a communication style that was effective. It was effective in laying out an issue, describing options to address it, and then letting you somewhat conclude along with his oration or his speech that the right action or the correct action was what he had proposed or would be proposing. So I always found, either in reading his books or listening at him, that Julian utilized very effective communication skills. And that just kind of makes me bounce back to when he was communications director of SNCC, and what he would do, at least from what I read, is he was very instrumental in getting the word out about activities and events. He understood the relationship between broadcast media, I believe, and what was happening in the field or in the cities or in the lunch counters, and that drew attention and provided some coverage of those events and probably led to some safer outcomes for individuals participating in those events.
And, Greg, what has the civil rights movement lost with one of its elders, Julian Bond, one of its witnesses and participants in history?
Well, I think on a personal level, I think when you lose an individual like that who was so important and such an important part for so many years, I don't know if you can replace that. But I think what you hope for is that the legacy and influence of an individual's presence during that movement has inspired individuals and has transpired the movement to be much, much broader and bring in different people who can continue it. I think what I want to see, and I think what will happen, is we will see a continuation of the movement. And I think that movement, at least I'm speaking from Dane County and our role here in NAACP, and I know other groups that are interested in civil rights, social justice, equality, I think what you'll see is a much more sustained approach, because the issues, structural and systematic, that exist now, that marginalize people and certainly discriminatory in the face, whether it's voting restrictions or voting redistricting, those kind of issues now are going to require people to be much more aware of them, much more knowledgeable of them, and much more proactive in terms of addressing them. So I think what that movement has done, whether I think about John Lewis, Martin Luther King, Foreman, and all of the great stewards who were there, that it's now people, me and younger, who would be in a position to say, we must carry on the legacy because the flame of the torch, must stay alive.
Greg, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
As Greg Jones, president of the Dane County chapter of the NAACP. Like supper clubs, the waterways of our state play a large role in our culture. Joining us now to tell us more about the Fox River is Earl Rohde. He's the author of The Little River That Could, a children's book about the Fox River. Earl, welcome to Central Time.
Hi.
Well, Earl, why did you decide to write your first book at the age of 85?
Well, I guess I would have to say primarily because I grew up in the village of Partyville. My wife and I both did. We attended school here in Partyville, and it is our hometown, and we live back in Partyville now. Partyville happens to be the home of the first lake on the Fox River called Park Lake, and it's a gem, and sort of overlooked gem. And as a matter of fact, we are east of Portage, so this is the first lake on the Fox River, and there's also another gem just to the west of here toward Portage called Swan Lake, and that is one of the nicest lakes in southern Wisconsin. Is also, I guess I would have to refer to it as a unknown secret in southern Wisconsin, along with Park Lake. And the reason for that probably in that the fact that they're somewhat overlooked is because of the rivers after Swan Lake. Fox River only goes about 3 miles and goes to the city of Portage. And, of course, Portage absolutely reeks of Wisconsin history. There is a lot of history involved. In fact, I think I saw a guy on Main Street in Portage there the other day looking for an arrowhead.
Mm. Well, so would you say you were trying to draw attention to the Fox River and help it get its due?
Yes. Back to why I wrote the book. Part because I was from Partyville here, and it's my hometown. I hunted and fished here as a youth, and I know the Fox River pretty well. And the Fox River, before it even formed its first lake here in Partyville, took a very erratic, unusual, blazed an unusual trail from the original springs, which start about 15 miles or so east yet of Partyville in the Friesland-Cambria area. And there a few springs came together, and the little Fox River was very happy and proud, wanted to be a big river someday. And it talked to Mother Nature, and Mother Nature asked it, well, where did you want to go? And, well, where am I going now? And the little fox said, well, Mother Nature said, you're going north. And the little fox said, I love going north. I want to go north. Well, actually, that would be very unusual, because there is probably less than a handful of rivers in the United States that flow north. Almost all rivers flow south. But it was going north as a youth and went for a few miles north into Green Lake County, and then it bent west, and then it bent south again, and then it was getting kind of nervous because it didn't want to go south. It wasn't as happy. So when it got to Port Partyville coming south, it did make a 90-degree bend and was able to move west, heading right toward Portage, only being 9 miles away.
So this is an unusual trajectory for a river, isn't it?
It's quite unusual, yes, because almost all rivers in the nation flow south.
So how did the river's flowage affect the town of Portage?
Well, the town of Portage, did you say, or Partyville?
Right, of Portage and, I guess, of Partyville, yeah.
Well, of Partyville, because it did turn west, and it continued west for about 3 or 4 miles, five, and did form another probably nicest lake in southern Wisconsin, Swan Lake. So it was happier, but it did want to continue to go north again if it could. Well, when it got to Portage, only another 3 or 4 miles from Swan Lake, it did a very unusual bend in the Fox River when it was only 7,000 feet, or just a shade more than 1 mile from the huge Wisconsin River, because it heard this rushing water coming from its south, and heard that it was going to the Gulf of Mexico. It fought all it could to try to go north again. And when it was that 7,000 feet from the Wisconsin River, it did make a 90-degree bend, actually within the city limits of the city of Portage, and it never stopped going north then after that bend until it went to Green Bay, went through the waters, went through 4 of the 5 Great Lakes, over Niagara Falls, up into the Nova Scotia area, and emptied into the Atlantic Ocean. And if you come back to Portage, when it was only 7,000 feet away from the Wisconsin, it would have gone to the Gulf of Mexico. So that's, I guess, why I titled my book The Little River That Could, because I knew that the Fox, before it even got to Portage, had an unusual story.
Yeah, and you talk about it as though it has a personality. Obviously, you're talking about the river in the voice of your book, but do you see this as a river almost with a personality?
I do. I am, and if you could drive up to that 90-degree turn in the Fox within the village or city limits of Portage, and you could stand on the bank where it made that second 90-degree turn, I'm absolutely convinced that it really wanted to go north and didn't want to go to the Gulf of Mexico. It is quite amazing, I think.
And Earl, how is your book being received so far? You've worked with some schools. What do kids say?
It's doing quite well, I would say, pretty much locally, because I haven't got up off the couch enough to promote it like I should. But it is available on Amazon, and I'm happy with the way it's going, and I'm very delighted and happy and flattered when a grandfather once in a while will come up with his grandchildren and introduce me as the author, because I've never been called an author before.
Well, Earl, we leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for allowing me.
That was Earl Rohde, the author of the children's book, The Little River That Could. We've been talking about the significance and geography of the Fox River. Coming up, we'll take a look at the history and science behind the traditional Wisconsin Supper Club. We want you to tell us your favorite supper club on the Central Time Facebook page. That's coming up next after the news. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. You're listening to Central Time. We're taking a look at a prized Wisconsin institution, the Supper Club. Wisconsin Public Television and UW-Madison have teamed up to create a documentary called Supper Club 101, which airs tonight at 7 o'clock on Wisconsin Public Television. Here's a clip from the program with people trying to get a handle on just what exactly a supper club is.
Each place is unique, but each is considered a supper club. Just what that means depends on whom you ask.
Supper Club, I believe, is a family-run business. It's not a chain. And you have unique family recipes and unique regional recipes to that area.
Well, it's relaxed. Obviously, it's not fast food.
If you walk in and you see a full bar, a big bar in a Supper Club, with a great bartender behind the bar, that's what Supper Clubs are, I feel.
So we thought this would be a perfect opportunity to look at the historical, social, and scientific influences on what makes Supper Club so special. And we're joined today by two people featured in that documentary. Erwin Goldman is the department chair and professor of horticulture at UW-Madison. Erwin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Therese Allen writes about Wisconsin's culinary traditions and is a co-author of the books The Flavor of Wisconsin and The Flavor of Wisconsin for Kids. Therese, thanks for being here.
It's great to be here.
Well, Therese, as we just heard, supper clubs mean different things to different people. In your opinion, what is it that makes a supper club a supper club?
Well, first of all, it's definitely a family-run or independent restaurant. It's not necessarily just supper. It could be dinner and lunch. And it's not really a club. Everybody is welcome. They tend to be located near a lake, golf course, in a tourist area, sometimes on the main streets. Each place is different, looks different, has different decor, often with a theme, sometimes reflecting the family's what their likes and their history and that sort of thing. They work very hard, and there's a core menu at all supper clubs that varies in terms of the specific styles of cooking, but you always get steaks, you always get fish, you always get some kind of chicken. There's nightly specials. Friday night is going to be the fish fry. Saturday is going to be prime rib. If you're in a country place, you might get a chicken dinner on Sundays. And you're going to start with a relish tray or some kind of wonderful salad or salad bar. And you're going to finish with maybe a grasshopper or a piece of cheesecake. And you're going to be very full and you're going to take a doggy pig home.
And Erwin, what about you? Anything to add about what makes a supper club a supper club?
I think Teresa's description is just right on target. You know, for me, it's it is obviously each one is individual and each one is unique, but I'm particularly attracted to the vegetable side of things. And it's that relish tray that really sticks out in my mind as sort of being one of the defining things about the Supper Club.
And what goes on that relish tray?
You know, I'm just fascinated by the sort of traditional vegetables that have become important to the state. I mean, you know, you have your cucumber pickles, of course, but you have sweet corn and you have peas and you have snap beans and you have beets and carrots, all of these sort of traditional canning and processing vegetables that have become so closely associated with Wisconsin agriculture over the years.
And did that affect what the Supper Club Fair was? We have this short growing season here in Wisconsin. Does that mean the relish tray shrinks in the winter?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, yeah, I think, you know, probably 1860s, 1870s, Wisconsin began growing these vegetable crops that are fairly short season that are perfect for processing and for canning. And there were canning factories in so many of the towns in Wisconsin. And there still is a very strong canning industry here in the state. And it could be peas and sweet corn. It could be beets and carrots. It could be beans. All of those things were processed here. And I think in some way that those vegetables became featured in many of the restaurants in the state, and they became sort of staples, mainstays of the diet.
And Teresa, another factor here alongside that relish tray is that the Supper Club experience is often described as an event. It's not just a dinner. You could spend a whole evening there historically. How did it fit into the social context?
It's very, very important in Wisconsin. The social side of supper clubs are as important as the food itself and the drinks themselves, which of course are old fashions usually, and or maybe a Manhattan or a glass of local beer. But we, being a state that has a large German-influenced population, from our immigration in the 1900s, we have a strong propensity for something called Gemütlichkeit, which, boy, that's one of those terms that means so many things. You can say that it's about sociability. It's about being together. It's about talking and discussing things together. It's about spending time together around food and around drink. The drink is also important in the state. So we sometimes hear about Wisconsin having a party culture. It comes from that. And that's what plays into supper clubs so much.
We're talking right now with food writer Therese Allen and UW horticulturist Erwin Goldman about the history and science that defines Wisconsin supper clubs. And we'd like to hear from you. What is your favorite supper club in Wisconsin? What's your go-to dish? What says supper club more than any other? Have they changed over the years? Have you seen that, or is part of the charm that supper clubs stay the same? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave us a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. Erwin, when we look at the vegetable standards that you get at the Supper Club, has it changed over the years? As technology changes, as you get different varietals of vegetables, do you look at it and say, look, there's the evolution on the plate?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it takes a keen observer probably, but over time, our vegetables, like all of our crops, have evolved. So today, our sweet corn is extremely sweet and much less corny than it used to be. And old timers will say that they miss those traditional flavors. Same with things like green beans, which had flavor at one time and now seem to be more rubbery and lack flavor. So I think if you go back to particularly the heirloom varieties that used to be grown in the state a long time ago, there were different textures and flavors that aren't there today.
That's interesting. Can you still get that less sweet corn, or is it just phased out?
You can get it. You have to look for heirloom varieties, and particularly corns that are called super sweets are the type we typically grow today, and they tend to be very, very sugary, but have a watery sort of flavor to them and not a lot of corny flavor. If you wanted to taste that older flavor, that corny flavor, and a little bit of more of a creamy mouthfeel, which was traditional in the sweet corns up until, say, the 1950s or 60s, you'd have to grow a corn called sugary, and that would be an heirloom variety.
Hmm. And so in its form on the relish tray, would you see that as a pickled sweet corn or some other in jelly?
It could be canned, most likely canned. And I would say probably it would show up not only on the relish tray, but it would show up in other parts of the meal too. All of those canned vegetables, which are still canned today, but also frozen, just processed in some way.
Hmm. And Therese, you mentioned the fish fries earlier as being a staple of Supper Club Fair. And these are especially popular in the summer, but kind of all year round in Wisconsin these days. What do we know about the origins of the fish fry?
Oh, the fish fry. Oh, fish fry is one of those wonderful traditions, and I'm really glad you asked me about that one, because Erin might like the relish tray the best, but I'm all about the perch fry.
The perch fry. Or so the fish fry. You're going for the perch.
Yeah, I'm going for the perch because I grew up in Green Bay, and of course, that's where we get the wonderful lake perch, and that's kind of, in a sense, almost the epicenter of fish fries in Wisconsin. But the fish fry is really a combination of things. Came from a combination of things. It has to do very much with our Catholic background, because so many people in Wisconsin are Catholic or are familiar with Catholicism, and they traditionally did not eat meat on Fridays. So also geographically and climatically, we're just all about fish in this state. If you look at a state map, what you're going to see is Lake Superior to the north, and the Mississippi on the west, and Lake Michigan on the east. And I mean, in between, there's literally about 15,000 lakes, and I don't know how many thousands of miles of rivers. So it's part of our culture. It's part of our history. It's part of who we are. We're fish eaters. And then this little thing called Prohibition also had something to do with fish fries, because during Prohibition, when taverns and you know, country restaurants needed a way to get people to come in during the ban on alcohol, they would offer fish fries for lunch or for dinner, either free or really cheap. And these large Catholic families who were getting their payday was Fridays, they could come in and get a cheap or inexpensive meal. And the tradition kind of stuck that way, sort of evolved out of that, not just as a place for adults to go, but really as an intergenerational thing. So we have all these sort of factors that come in.
Interesting. And I've noticed just recently that in this region, in southern Wisconsin, it seems as though your fish fries are served with French fries or maybe some other Parmesan sort of potato, creamy potato. In Milwaukee and toward the lake, potato pancakes.
That's right. That's the German influence.
Mm-hmm. That's the Gemütlichkeit influence coming out again.
That's the Gemütlichkeit. And the fish itself varies around the state, too. I like to imagine sometimes that I'm just dropped in a town someplace, like any town, and if you served me the fish fry and I tasted the fish, or you told me what the type of fish was, I could tell you where I was, because if it was the Green Bay area, it would be perch.
Really?
Sure. And if you're maybe in the North Woods, it would be walleye or bluegill. If you're near the Mississippi, it would be catfish. So you can place yourself by the fish you're eating.
We're talking right now to horticulturist Erwin Goldman and food writer Therese Allen. Right, we're talking about the history and science of supper clubs now, and we want to hear from you. Do you have a favorite supper club that you like to go to? How about a favorite dish? And any changes you've noticed over the years, or do you think that supper clubs are a beautiful time capsule of Wisconsin history? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can comment over on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our discussion today with food writer Therese Allen and horticulturalist Erwin Goldman about supper clubs and their unique ties to the state of Wisconsin. You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. We want to know about your favorite supper club in Wisconsin, your go-to dinner order, and what sticks with you. Why do you think they've endured for so long? You can also leave us a comment over on the Central Time Facebook page. And we go to our phones right now. We've got George on the line from Okachi. George, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I've been a supper club bartender for 30 years, working at Weisgerber's Golden Mast on Okachi Lake. It was founded in 1967, continuously operated by the same German immigrant family. And, you know, I'd just like to talk about the need to evolve as a supper club, because the things we offered 30 years ago are very far from the things we offer now on our menu. We have a lot more fresh salad and different menu items and fusion type of cooking. And I don't think that we would have been able to survive had we just stuck with our the things that we did.
Interesting. 30
years ago.
George, besides the salads, what else has gone and what else has shown up on the menu?
We certainly have a lot more steaks and fresh seafood than we used to. Our fish fry is still hugely popular. And that hasn't changed virtually at all in 30 years. But we also have a lighter fare menu and appetizers and small plate menus, you know, which cater to the taste of people the way they eat now.
Great. Well, George, appreciate that call. And Erwin, let's go to you. Does that sound like what you've seen as
absolutely
over the
I mean
years?
There's such a strong pull now, I think, to eat fresh and to eat eat fruits and vegetables that are locally grown. And so that feeds exactly into what George was saying, I think, about the sort of consumer preference.
And I've been hearing you talk about beets a little as we sit here. Are you a big beet fan?
I am.
Do they have a role in the Supper Club?
Absolutely. I mean, the beets are really my favorite part of it. They are, you'd find pickled beets, I think, probably most commonly, but also canned beets. And those two things would show up on those menu items in various different ways, including the relish tray. And I'm particularly interested in the vegetable because, but aside from its beauty and the deep color, you have that earthy flavor. And I think the earthiness is the thing that both attracts people to it and it also repels people from it. And so I think it's a fascinating part of the vegetable universe there.
Definitely a taste of a Wisconsin terroir, though.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of terroir. I mean, we actually do research on those flavor compounds and have learned a lot about it in recent years. But it is something that I think that earthiness takes people back to something very, very basic and very, very simple, whether it's turning over the soil in a garden as a child or something about the smell of the earth. It's a very, very, very deep connection.
And Teresa, do you want to respond at all to George?
Sure, I'm going to go home and cook some beets. But I think George really hit on something that is terribly important, a really important reason that Wisconsin is a place where supper clubs have endured, especially compared to the rest of the United States and even the Midwest, and that's that they have evolved over time. They have kept up with food trends. They do really focus on what we produce and grow and gather here in the state. That ties in so closely with the local foods movement, which is very big here in Wisconsin, especially in southern Wisconsin, where so many vegetables grow. But really, all of the kinds of foods that we grow and produce in the state, the dairy, the fish, the meats, and the vegetables, and that's been part of the evolution. And the local foods sort of emphasis, people are really feeling proud of the fact that here's a supper club. It's kind of a step back in time, but in fact, it's really with it. It's really doing, always been doing. We're still doing what we've always been doing.
Well, thank you so much for that call, George. And we're going to go next to Brian in Endeavor. Brian, hello.
Hello there. I'd like to throw in my two cents for Cimarole Supper Club between the Dells and Portage on Highway 127. They've got a flat iron steak to die for. And from 4 o'clock, six nights a week, from 4 o'clock till 9 o'clock, you're on a waiting list.
Okay, that sounds like a hop in place. Cimarole's between Portage and the Dells. Any comments about that one, Therese?
That's one I don't know, but of course, when I hear the Dells, I immediately think of Ishnala, classics like Ishnala and the Dell Bar and Embers, all of which I'm familiar with, but I'm going to try that one too.
I just tried Ishnala, but I'm always surprised. I was surprised that I'd never heard of Ishnala.
Uh-huh.
And I'm always surprised when I hear about other supper clubs that people love, and I've lived here a long time and I've never heard of. How many supper clubs are there?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, some people say about 300, some I've heard 450, I've heard thousands. There probably was a time when there were 1,000 or more. But I think if you go and look across the state at places that call themselves supper clubs, there's about 450. And so you've got to count some more because some don't call themselves supper clubs in the name.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that Wisconsin has been proactive in staying with the food trends, changing with the times. So how does that compare to the rest of the country? Are they extinct in the rest of the country or just more prevalent here in Wisconsin?
They're more prevalent here in Wisconsin. If you look at a map of the Midwest, for example, there's a wonderful book about supper clubs by Dave Hoekstra, and he actually does look at Wisconsin versus the other states in the Midwest, and we are peppered with supper clubs compared to the rest. And I think it has, there's so many things we've touched on. The Gemut Lakhaitit is a factor there. Agriculture, our connection to agriculture is very strong, and the variety of foods. The local foods movement is another one. I think tourism is another huge, huge factor because tourists and tourism are so, and supper clubs are so much in tourist areas. But I think probably more than anything else, I just feel like supper clubs, there's this sort of alignment of stars that goes on. There's a connection when you walk into a supper club, especially if you're a resident and you're in this place, you're feeling this history, you've got this culture, the food, it's all familiar, but it's also all communal. We're all eating together. We're all sitting down at the same table and eating basically from the same plates from the same pots and from the same menu. And so there's this just sort of alignment. I feel like when we're in a supper club in Wisconsin, you know, the world is right. All is right with the world.
Oh, well put. Well, we're talking with food writer Therese Allen and UW horticulturist Erwin Goldman about the history and science that defines Wisconsin supper clubs. We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. And we go down to Tim. Tim joins us from Rice Lake. Hello, Tim.
Hi, it's Jim.
Oh, sorry, Jim.
From Rice Lake. And I just wanted to put a plug for Rice Lake's finest supper club that's been in family-owned for probably at least 70 years. It's Lehman's, L-E-H-M-A-N-S, and on Saturday nights they have a hand-rubbed prime rib that is to die for. And they have traditional foods, but they have outstanding seafood, and they have adapted to using locally grown, freshly cooked ingredients and products. And I think it's the children of the original founders that are still in business. And it's not only an isolate, it's a brilliant restaurant, and an iconic Rice Lake landmark.
Terrific. Well, thank you, Jim, for calling up and sharing that one with us. Lehman's in Rice Lake. And, Erwin, you talked about adding the fresh vegetables, fresh ingredients. I'm assuming that there's still a place, though, the fresh ingredients alongside the preserves.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the things about, you know, of course, Wisconsin has this very interesting climate where we have an intense winter, which is one of the great things about our agriculture, that it can actually kill a lot of insects. So it's a nice thing for us to be able to grow our crops in that short season. But the fact that we can grow storage vegetables or even vegetables that are highly perishable and store them, this just adds and extends our season. So we've got fresh vegetables for a very large number of months of the year, and then we have processed for the rest. And I think it's a perfect way to round out the menu for the whole year.
Terrific. Well, thank you for that call. We're going to go next to a quick one here from Cindy in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Well, I'm hungry, but two of my favorite places to go in Wisconsin, the first one is the Union House in Genesee Depot, which is apparently one of the really older supper clubs in the state. And then my other favorite place is called the Pine Barren in Manitowish Waters, although I'm not sure if they're still in existence, but they used to start you out with a little dish of cranberry pate and crackers. So.
Nice. All right, well, appreciate that. And our technical director, Michelle Good, is nodding that they are still in business. She knows her supper clubs. But appreciate hearing about a couple more there. Union House in Genesee Depot, Pine Barren in Manitowish Waters. And Teresa, as we start wrapping up here, supper clubs have endured. They've changed, that much is clear, over the years. And they've also endured, though. Do you see that part of their beauty is sort of this tradition living alongside the modern, and it's brought the agriculture movement along with it?
Absolutely. You pretty much said it right there. It's all of these things together. It's that that sense of we're proud of what we've got here, and we enjoy having it together, and it's very much our sense of identity.
Excellent. Well, lots of hungry people out there today. Any favorite recommendations before we let you go?
That's dangerous, isn't it? Well, I know where I want to go next because I've never been, and that's the Hobnob in Racine.
The Hobnob in Racine.
Right, right.
Erwin, anything from you? A favorite dish?
Aside from all the pickled vegetables. No, I agree with what Therese said about the perfect nature, the way this sort of aligns with all of the Wisconsin culture. And I guess I'd also say that I think it points to the relatively healthy diet and the sort of the varied diet that's been a part of this tradition as well. I mean, that's another thing to be proud of.
Well, thank you both so much for joining me.
Thank you, right back.
Thank you.
That was UW-Madison horticulture expert Erwin Goldman, Therese Allen, also food writer and author of The Flavor of Wisconsin. They joined us today to explore the history and science behind Wisconsin supper clubs. You can catch both of them in the documentary Supper Club 101, airing tonight at 7 o'clock on Wisconsin Public Television.